All right. This filing came as a result of much union activity, which we haven't gone into, but I did help. I was one of the first women who came forward in a strong way and became, because they had women on the executive and so on, but began to work very strongly and with the men. I organized, brought together the communists whom I recognized in the shop and formed a shop club, which was not even part of the Communist Party's program at that time. But I said if we worked in the plant, we have to get together. And so we organized a core, we organized inside the union, we were able to carry on a lot of activities. We were able to break the back of the company in many of the contract developments. I was on the contract committee. After a while, I became recognized in the shop. After I became a steward in my own department and began to fight and win things, and then I realized that I was getting into trouble with the guys, and I retreated and said, my God, I'm pushing them, not because they were men, but because I was more advanced than they were politically, and I was pushing for things that were not possible yet, and the workers were not ready to fight for. So I kind of retreated and then started talking and then developing things, and then we began to develop a whole number of things. And because of all of this activity and the role that I began to play in the shop as a whole, as a center, and I became a known communist. I distributed papers openly, I distributed books, I had meetings at my home and other homes where I invited people from my department to come and learn about the Communist Party, and it was public knowledge. The company was fighting back on this basis. When I was fired, it was already in the period of layoff after the war, and the company used that as one of the excuses, and we mounted an arbitration case. We went as far as the arbitration case. At that time, unknown to us, the trial had begun in Foley Square in New York City against a group of communist leaders who were arrested and for teaching and advocating the overthrow of the government. That was the first of the Foley Square trials. And without our knowledge, one of the people who turned up as a witness for the government was one of the guys who had worked at the plant and was in our communist club group. And he testified against the party leaders, especially the Bill Green, who was the one who was arrested from out of Chicago. And we found out when we got to the arbitration that the company had sent somebody to the trial, and he brought back a transcript of the man's testimony about the group there, and they used that in the arbitration to prove that they had a right to fire me. So we had a very interesting arbitration in which we proved through all kinds of means that we had at our disposal, time charts and all kinds of things, that my work was very efficient, that I was a very good worker, in fact, and that my work was very efficient, and that I was running machines that nobody else could handle, you know, and so on. And secondly, they brought down to prove that I had intimidated the workers. That was the other thing. They brought some witnesses down from the department to tell some stories about what kind of a person I was and so on. And so we developed, in the arbitration, we developed a slowdown in that department. Now remember, I'm not in there anymore. I'm already fired. But the workers came down to testify for me at the arbitration. And we brought them in groups. The company just nearly died. They were furious. And we kept saying, but they have to come down. We can't testify that. So we kept bringing them down and actually developed a stoppage in the department by doing it. But the workers were just magnificent. And they told that I had told them that I was communist, and they said that they listened because they always understood that communists were for people having bad conditions and so on, so they would have a revolution. But I was always fighting for things to improve, for getting higher wages, for getting the dirt cleaned up, you know, and so on. And they testified that I was a good worker, that I was a good steward, and that all these things that were being said were not true. And they testified against the foreman, against the assistant foreman, and so on. And actually, when the case was finally settled, we won the arbitration case. The union won the arbitration case. But by that time, other things had happened in the plant, and the union was eventually pushed out by the new Taft-Hartley law. You know, that comes later on. But I just wanted to complete the story so you get a picture of what happened then. There are many interesting stories during the organizing, but the point is that this was a highlight of what happened.
Were any of those people who testified for you, did they lose their jobs?
No. They were afraid to do anything at that time. They were still working in the plant and did not lose their jobs. But the point was, the beauty of it was that they were not intimidated to the point where they
Wouldn't say anything,
even though there weren't enough jobs. They could have been laid off, but they were willing to come down and testify and stay there. And they were just their whole relationship, the way they talked about this person who came and said that I had intimidated, you know, and they exposed her, you know, and so on, was absolutely a magnificent display of Lippis' courage and solidarity that. You know, that, you know, I've seen in such a personal way. You
know. November 30th, 1977, interview 3 begins with Florence Kirshner on 10th Avenue, Los Angeles, California. Tell me about 1944.
Well, in 1944, I went back to work. My husband joined the army, and I was along with the two children. One was a year and a half, the other one was about five and a half. And I decided that it was not possible to maintain an apartment, my own place, and a car that was left with me. And other things that I wanted to do on just the money that I would get from the Army. So I decided to go back to work, and I wanted to be back in the plant, in the war work, and I decided to go back to try to get into Stuart Warner, which was a big plant at that time, and I had worked there once before.
Well, you said you got money from the Army. How much money did you get?
Yeah, I don't remember the exact amount, but there was an allotment. A soldier could take a small piece of his pay off, and the government would put some more to it, depending on how many children. So you got a small allotment from the Army every month. But it was not enough to be able to live on, and I did not want to move in with anybody. I wanted to maintain my own place and to keep the children, you know, to try it alone anyway, it's the best I could.
If you went, like going back to work, you didn't lose the allotment?
No.
Okay.
No, you didn't lose the allotment. That was based on his pay. And he agreed to put a certain amount off, and they matched it with other money. I don't remember the exact
amount. Was he a private?
Well, sure, he entered as a private. When I went to work at Stuart Warner, I had, I think I described before, the problems of children having to go to nursery school and all that kind of thing, but that was a part of what women had to put up with in order to be able to continue living in any kind of out of poverty level. Stuart Warner had been organized by the time I got there. It was in the United Electrical Radio and Radio Workers at that time, United Electrical Radio and Machine Workers. And it was a third try at unionization with that union. It had a long history of union busting. The company was noted for that. But they finally, with the War Labor Board and under the new rulings and so on, they finally were able to win an election, and NLRB, National Labor Relations Board election, and the union was in there when I arrived. And of course, I became a member of the union and tried to become active in the union as quickly as I could. I was in a very interesting department. It was a sort of what was known as a cleanup department. It had a little bit of many operations, drill press work, milling machines, all kinds of little presses and cleanup jobs and sanders and various things, including a few large machines. But many of the parts went through this department in order to be completed. Stuart Warner basically was an instrument, made instruments for various things, for boats, for speedometers, for cars, for all kinds of things. Of course, during the war, made instruments and other things for the war effort, for whatever was needed. Once I started working in the shop, eventually I became active in the union. I was able to function because the union had a headquarters, the local had headquarters two blocks away, sort of around the corner. And I used to do a great deal of work in the plant itself during working hours. And then I would run over there right after to the union hall to take care of business. If we had meetings, we always had them right after work so that the people wouldn't have to come back again. And then I would run home from there and pick up the kids, or they would be delivered, depending on what the nursery situation was at the time. And then, be home with them and do other things. But that's beside the point. Eventually, I became the steward of the department, or one of the stewards of the department. And eventually, I was elected to the executive committee of the local, and eventually I was on the bargaining committee, the local bargaining committee that worked out the contract with the company. But that's over a long period of time. I don't think that I want to go into all of the different things. There were very many exciting things that happened in the plant, and it was a great experience for me, a great organizational experience for me personally, and for the development of the union in that period. But I don't think we can go through all the things that happened. But I do think that there are some important things that happened that should be discussed. I think I did mention before that all through the time that I was working at the plant and the union was in the plant, this company never let up on its anti-union program and was always trying to find new ways and means of attacking the union, including sending people into the union to run for office and to be elected as stewards and to get into all the bodies of all the steward of the union, all the committees and so on, and running. There was, for instance, one time in which they actually ran a company union slate against the union slate that was running. Now, it's true that the company, we were a group of left-wingers, if you want to call that, in the local, but we had quite a good coalition of all groups, including some very conservative of the people in the union, and it was not something that was just taken over by the left and hugged, as sometimes does happen. But the fact of the matter is that we were constantly in battle with the company, whether it was on a level in the department, whether it was in negotiations, whether it was in elections that we were holding. No matter what the union was doing, the company was running, was actually working against it and running against it. So that you can see that this was never stopped, and that what I'm leading up to is when the union finally was tried by the anti-labor law, the Taft-Hartley law that was passed, it was a culmination of one battle after the other with this company. And I wanted to lay that background in order to let you know the effect that the tax poverty law had on many shops, especially those which had never been able to consolidate as well as others, you know, within the framework of large auto plants, you know, and so on. So the effect of this battle, of course, was that it developed many people, many activists in the union, because once they, you know, you always had an enemy that was visible. It was not, you were not negotiating compromises. You were fighting, you were battling all the time. And that was, in a sense, very good for us, particularly for me as a woman leader. There were a large number of women who developed in the struggle once they, you know, saw people coming forward. There were a lot of large number of black people who came forward in the struggle, and the union became really developed a whole slew of very class conscious people, good fighters, you know, who were ready to stand ground for the union until they were hit by other things. But at that point, it was an exciting organizational, you know, development for us. Now, one thing that should be known, in the time that I was in the plant, the Communist Party had the Communist Political Association going that I described earlier in larger groups, and it was the atmosphere at that time, because of the relationship of the Allies fighting against the Hitler forces, you know, and so on, there was a feeling that one could become more open as communists, and a number of us became known as communists in the plant, and I was one of those, and that's also part of the experience of being attacked all the time, red-baited all the time, and yet being able to win election after election in the department and to win to the other committees, you know, and so on. And many times I came in with very high votes because of carrying on the work in the plant and being recognized for that rather than for. So this had an effect on us, on the union too, because of the Taft-Hartley law took on the question of communists in the unions, which I'll describe a little bit later. But we had a number of known communists in the local. I was the key. I was passing out communist literature. I was selling, I and others, some people would come to help us from our community groups and so on. We were selling the communist newspaper once a week outside the plant. We were putting out leaflets. I had a couple of meetings of some of the women in my department at homes where they wanted to know about communism, and I talked with them about it. So I was a known communist in the plant. That's what was led up to when I was eventually fired, led up to that being one of the charges against me that I described in that arbitration case. Now, the Communist Party, we had quite a number of members, I would say maybe 15 members in the plant, and I did assemble them as part of, was not part of the direction of the Communist Party at that time, but since we were all working in the plant and in the local, I decided that if we were all going to be there, we ought to be working together. And so we finally got a club together, a group, and we used to meet to see what was going on, to try to figure out how to develop the battle of the workers.
Did you have a name for your group or club?
No, we were not an official club at that time, you see, because there were no such things as shop clubs.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of what happened to the party at that time. But even though there was not supposed to be any shop clubs, we did have a club going, we used to meet. Now, this had an effect on the work in the plant, and of course, it's unusual. Later on, we realized that it's still a fact of life that in the plants you cannot, you basically cannot be an open communist, because even in the best of times, the attack on communists has always been, in one form or another, takes place with the help of a company, develop all kinds of methods of attack, whether it's, in some cases, it's just keeping you out of the leadership, in other cases, it's it was actually the loss of jobs and so on. Now we have other things which don't permit, many plants don't permit communists, will not hire communists, don't permit communists. In most of the locals, there are clauses that do not permit communists to be officers of the union. Still, that still exists, even though eventually the Supreme Court threw out the that section of the law which said that you must be must not have been a member of a communist party for 5 years and so on, and you know, not knowingly, you know, all this terminology finally was thrown out. But meantime, most of the unions did not permit communists to be officers, and many still have the clauses in their constitutions which do not permit communists to be officers, and in some cases not even members.
Why were you not supposed to have clubs?
This is related to the communist movement. That time was under the leadership of Earl Braga, and we were going through a period of an enlightened capitalism, because we were all allies. They were all fighting together with the socialism, with socialists and the capitalist countries, and therefore they were going to be enlightened, and it was going to be easier to have big clubs and open clubs, and you'd be able to have discussion, and you would be able to present things and debate things and so on, and there would not be this attack. Well, of course, that ended before long, and then the other side of the whole McCarthy period that came on was the antithesis of this, you know, later on. But this was the thinking at the time, and this was so we did not have secretive groups, because actually I belonged to a communist club in the community of some 150 people. You know, whatever the club was, each club was quite large, you know, the whole areas. We had a lot of members at that time, had people that joined the Communist Party with the fight against fascism. Okay, so this was what was going on in the plant. Now, all during the war years, the UE was considered a left-oriented union. And it was a very progressive union. It was very much in support of the fight against Hitlerism, against fascism. It was very much in support of the improvement of the workers' conditions. They had they were part of, together with auto, together with longshore, together with, you know, the other unions, part of the unions that participated in developing the War Labor Board, the whole National Labor Relations Board, you know, the whole process. There was a lot of organizing. They organized a lot of shops, and they organized a lot of chains. You know, that is Westinghouse, General Electric, you know, various big chains, and small and large, and became a very, very strong union in the electrical industry, in the machine industry. And we were all part of that, too. Now, I don't think that I will go into all the problems within the union, because that's a whole other history in itself, but I'd like to stay with the shop, just with the plant that I was in. Well, when the war ended, there was a sizable layoff, because there was no more war work in that sense, and they had to reshuffle themselves back to other things and back to a different system of profit making. it was not being paid for by the government at this point, so it was not cost plus, as they called it. So they had to rearrange themselves, and they went. So that was a sizable layoff, but those stewards, you know, people who were in the union, were not laid off. They had the right to seniority because of being part of the union leadership. That was part of what you had for, you know, for giving leadership to the workers. But also, I was kept on the job. I mean, seniority withstood, and I had enough seniority to stay on for a while. But then started the direction in Congress for the anti-labor laws, particularly the Tartney law. And there was a tremendous campaign to try to keep it from being passed, and it finally was defeated.
Do you remember what year that was?
I mean, it finally was passed, excuse me. I believe 1948. And Truman, who had really fought against it for the moment, was signed it on the basis that he was going to repeal it, which never happened and still hasn't happened. Now, this law had a number of clauses in it that helped to dismantle a great deal of union shops after it was passed. In particular, it had a rule that said that that did not permit communists or members of the Communist Party or those associated with the Communist Party for 5 years previous. They had all kinds of language to be officers of the union. That meant that everybody had to declare that they were not. It meant that everybody had to sign. Your officers had to sign statements in order to be able to qualify to be on a ballot. All right. The union could be challenged. Those unions that existed in plants could be challenged by other unions. All they had to do was get a certain percentage of the cards signed that people wanted another union. They could do it, sometimes they could do it while the union was still in, but when you came to a contract ending time, and then you had to renew a contract, you could be challenged by another union coming in and saying that so many workers want to belong to their union and demanding a ballot, an election. Under that circumstance, the contract could not be renewed until such an election took place to find out who would be the bargaining agent. Okay? Now, the UE at that moment decided against signing the Taft-Hartley affidavits because on the basis of principle, it did not want to have to declare anybody's politics or anybody's anything. And therefore, if it did not sign, it could not be on the ballot, no matter how many workers it had in there. It followed the example to some extent the mine workers under John L. Lewis refused to sign the Taft-Hartley affidavits. But there was one big difference. They had the mine workers and they had the strength. And it didn't matter if you didn't want to deal with, if you had an election or not, if you didn't want to deal with them, you had a strike on your hands, mm-hmm. You couldn't get around it. This was not true with our union. But there was a big fight on the question of principle, and we had many discussions and many arguments. Later on, many of us who argued both ways, we felt that we were letting the workers down because by not being on the ballot, we were not able to fight for our rights. And later on, I think it was proven that it was a mistake, that actually it was not as important to not sign the affidavits as it was to be on the ballot and to be able to maintain the workers in the union. And Stuart Warner was a very good example of what companies did with that. When we refused to sign the affidavits, the company then said, that means that there's no union. You're not on the ballot. We were telling the workers that if you vote for no union, you're voting for the UE. Mm. against the IBEW that came in at that time, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. They were the ones who petitioned and were on the ballot. But the company said to the workers, and maintained it, that if you vote for no union, that's no union.
At all.
At all. Yeah. And if you want to get the union, you will have to strike at that point.
Mm-hmm.
See? And in effect, that's what happened. So the union was pushed out
mm-hmm.
by this, you know. And that was really important because this happened in many, many plants. In some places they won for a while, but eventually they would lose because of the raids that were taking place. And
describe a raid.
Even after the point where the union and other unions decided to sign the affidavits, which meant that people like myself, for instance, if they had signed the affidavits, I would not have been able to sign. I was a known communist. I would not have been able to be in the leadership of the union. I would have had to resign. Maybe some others, you know, that kind. In some cases, even when they didn't resign, the raiding union would use it. The whole attack on the union would not be on their conditions that they had won in the shop or on the democratic method in which the union was conducted, you know, or not conducted, but it would be an attack on leadership, on this one's a communist and they were seen here and they were part of this and they signed this anti-fascist petition and that they were they went to the Wallace by the Russell Party, which then indicated that they were related to communists, you know, and so if that was a basic way in which the unions were torn down. This whole red baiting took over a large part of the attack. Now, a raid, was given to that moment when the contract talks were opening up, and other union or unions would come in and say that they want to be on the ballot. Once enough cards were produced, other unions could intervene and also be on the ballot. So you could have a ballot of a number of unions. And it was a raid because it was actually not a new organizing venture.
Mm-hmm.
It was taking over some other union.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes even no union would win.
Mm.
So it would destroy unionism. Actually, right. And this raid thing was very, very harmful to people. If I may jump for a moment and describe a raid, later on I went to work for another UE plant after I was fired from Stuart Warner. I didn't get that, but later on, in 1950, I went back to work in the plant, and I went to another union, a plant organized by the UE, and I worked there for a while, a smaller plant, much smaller plant. And it was pretty much of a community plant, and many of the people who worked there, a lot of women working there, and many of them who worked there lived right around there, and came right from that area. And then I left from that plant, and I went away for a while, which I'll describe later. And when I came back, I went to the plant to visit, and they had been raided again by the IBEW. No, by that time the IUE was there. A new union was formed, the International Union of Electrical Workers, a split off from the UE, which then went on to raid the UE. Anyway, when I came back to the plant to visit, I walked in and everybody was so delighted to see me, and I had this big crowd, and I asked about some other people. Oh, they're sitting over there. Well, come on, let's go and see them. Well, you go see them yourself. And I went over to visit them, and it took me a while to realize that what had happened, that I knew there had been a raid, but what had happened was that the UE had won the plant, maintained its leadership in the plant, but the raid was so bitter, and people knew each other well, you know, they lived in the community, they weren't talking to each other. So even though the union was retained there, the sense of unionism and the ability to fight
had really been
destroyed in some measure. And when I came back to work in the plant, I went out trying to get them all together again and so on. But I mean, on the smaller scale, you could see it much more dramatically even than on the large scale. They absolutely were not talking to each other as in a small shop where they had to work together. Okay, then, so this, I wanted to describe this tripartite law for what it did now. This went on for a long time, and, still goes on even now. There's such a thing as raids. The latest you've seen is in the farm workers, where you see this in process. But at that particular time, and through that period of McCarthyism, when McCarthyism developed its height, the tripartite law in the shops became very widely used and really cut the left unions very sharply. And some of them finally did merge with other unions, you know, and so on, joined together in order to maintain their forces. So that it's a very sad moment in the history of union organizing in this country. Now, that will take us back then to, was during that period, before the election actually, that I went through this hearing, that I was fired and I went through this hearing that I described with the arbitration case. Mm-hmm. And it also relates to the fact that the Foley Square trial was on. That's a trial of 12 communist leaders who were arrested. And the trial was in Foley Square Court in New York, so it was called the Foley Square trial. And it's out of there that the company brought back the testimony that I described that was used.
You said that you did not get hired back, but you won your case, didn't you?
I won my case, but the shop was lost by that time.
Well, what kind of compensation did you get? Mac wages?
Nothing.
Anything?
I never was able to. By the time we got the decision, the shop was gone as far as the UE was concerned. There was nobody to carry on any fight at all. We would have had to go through courts and all kinds of other things. And by that time, we were pretty much embroiled. We did not carry it forward anymore.
Then what did you win?
Nothing.
Yes.
In a sense, I would never have gotten back to the plant, mm-hmm. even if they had to pay a little bit of back wages. Mm-hmm. That's what it would have amounted to. The reason I described it was because it was a culmination after going through all of these battles of the impact of the organizational experience that I described on workers and how they, when people are part of a good union, a good experience, they will stand up in the face of a great deal of adversity and not be intimidated. But I really never got back to that plant. Okay, now, following, you want to continue?
Go ahead.
Following the, when I left the plant, I went to work for the Communist Party at that time, full time. Because by this time the children were older, and they were in school, and so on. But I could manage my own time pretty much in that sense.
Did you have a paying position?
Yeah.
Could you tell me what it was?
Such as such as the pay was.
Yes.
Well, I was called the organizational secretary of the Illinois district.
Mm-hmm. You were living in Illinois at
Chicago.
This time? Oh,
well,
Chicago. You were still in Chicago. Okay.
Chicago was the center of Illinois. The party was under great stress at this time. There's much history in between other things that happened. A letter was written by a French communist leader, Duclos, pointing up the state of the whole concept of the Communist Political Association and the broader leadership. Many discussions took place, a couple of conventions took place. Prada was ousted. The Communist Party was reformed as a Communist Party. Shop clubs developed again, community clubs developed again. The whole position of the fight against capitalism was renewed and reinstituted. In some cases with other types of errors, but I don't believe that I should go into a whole description of all the communist history. I mean, I think that would be impossible, let me put it that way, so that I'm not going to describe all that. But so with some of these changes, we were very interested in getting working class people to come into leadership and to help to renew the party and the plants and amongst the working class and so on. And of course, the feeling is always that people who have working class experience and who have that kind of background and development and so on will give better kind of leadership than intellectuals or professional people and so on within certain scopes. Not that others need to be out, but that they don't give the same kind of direction, they don't know the same kind of lessons of how to work in the shop and the problems of the shop, and so on.
I'm concerned about that. Your husband came back from the war. What happened in terms of what did he do?
My husband came back after the war was over in 1945. He had been wounded in France. And he came back, and we tried to pick up the pieces, but some sharp differences developed between us. For one, he really wanted me to stay home and pick up the family, possibly have another child, and so on. And by that time, I was pretty well involved in giving leadership to all kinds of activities. I had really been part of a great deal, even though I had been part of activity with the children, but I wasn't ready to go back to that kind of thing anymore. I wanted to keep on working. And we made a mistake, I guess, in hindsight. We got, with the help of the union and so on, and as a vet, we got him